Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Anna Fishson, your host for this podcast. Today, I'm very excited to be talking to my friend and colleague, Thomas Kohut, about his book, A German Generation, An Experiential History of the 20th Century. Tom, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for talking to me.
Sure. Tom is, let me just introduce you. Tom is the Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III Professor of History at Williams College. He received his BA from Oberlin and his PhD from the University of Minnesota. He is also a graduate of the Cincinnati Psychoanalytic Institute. He's a member of the Board of Trustees of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and is chair of the Council of Scholars of the Eric Erickson Institute at Austin Riggs. Now, Tom's first book is the often cited exemplary psychohistory, Wilhelm II and the Germans, A Study in Leadership. It was published by Oxford University Press in 1991. And his recent book, which we'll be talking about today, is another fine psychohistory, although I don't know if he wants to claim that characterization, but we can discuss that. And in some ways, this book is even more courageous than the first. The main source base of the book consists of a little more than 60 interviews of Germans who had been part of the youth movement during the Weimar Republic. And these interviews were conducted in the 1990s, and most interviewees were in their early 20s, right, when Hitler came to power and during World War II. So Tom noticed that there was much narrative coherence across these interviews and decided to create 6 composite interviews. Now, the composite case is something that might be familiar in psychoanalytic writing, but in the world of historians, it's unusual and arouses much skepticism. And I'm a historian, and I was a bit surprised that I did not find them more problematic, actually. They were brilliantly executed, I think. So, but we'll hear much more about this shortly. Okay, so Tom, can you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and your reasons for writing the book?
Okay, well, I guess, you know, everything that I do, whether I'm teaching a history class at Williams or whether I'm writing scholarship, what I'm really interested in is human experience. I'm interested not in what happened, not in coming to some kind of objective understanding, an empirical understanding of what happened, but I'm interested in how human beings experienced themselves, the world in which they lived, why they thought things happened. Mm-hmm. And so this book is very much in keeping with all the work that I do as a historian, and I think it's actually very much in keeping with the way my kind of psychoanalyst listens to his or her patients. I'm very interested, mm-hmm. again, in how people experience themselves in their world. And this, you know, I actually worked briefly after I graduated from the Institute in Cincinnati, or even maybe during it, during my analytic training, as a research, I guess, candidate, it was called. I worked as a therapist, and I don't see in some ways a huge epistemological difference between the way historians understand human beings and the way psychoanalysts understand human beings. I think in both instances, one tries to think oneself inside the experience of the other person to understand their past and their present circumstances, and to try to understand from their point of view why they do what they do, and why they feel what they feel, and why they think what they think. And I guess for me, as a historian, I'm particularly interested in the maybe less in what they do and more in what they feel and what they think. And so that there's a kind of a, consistency of approach that connects this particular book with everything else that I do professionally. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it goes back profoundly to my family. I'm the son of the psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut, and my mom also had psychoanalytic education actually in Vienna in the 1930s, and was a psychiatric social worker. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a family where this was the way we looked at the world, and it's kind of in my DNA, but it's also in my the culture of the family, and it's how I interact with people generally. It kind of I guess to use the kind of the word associated often with my dad and often, I hope also with me, I try to take an empathic approach to people and an empathic approach to history. And so that's very, very much me and very much connected with everything I do. The book reflects that outlook. What's different about this project, different from any other project that I've ever done, is that the project picked me, and I didn't pick the project. I was offered money, and I got a nice stipend to join a large research project at the University of Siegen in Germany. In Germany in particular, in history, it's somewhat different from in the United States. History in Germany is very much a social science, and there are often very large group projects involving lots of different people, and this was one of those group projects. It was a study of members of an organization called the Free German Circle, which was an organization that had been founded after World War II. It was kind of a self-help organization for refugees at that point, and everybody who belonged to this organization had, as Anna mentioned earlier, been members of the youth movement in the 1920s. And they found one another after the war. They came together after the war. They provided each other with physical support, but I think especially emotional support. And this bond, this adolescent bond of the youth movement, sustained them throughout the course of their lives. And this organization, the Free German Circle, remained in effect until it was deliberately dissolved in the year 2000 in a kind of slightly grandiose but also slightly fitting end. They drew down the curtain on themselves. And during the period from the late 1940s until the year 2000, this organization flourished. It had, I don't know how many members, but over 2,000 members. I mean, it's well over that. I don't remember. I'm not very good at remembering numbers. They met. They had annual conventions. They had local chapters. They had a newsletter. It was in many ways the centerpiece of these people's lives. And this project was funded, oddly, by the German government, because it was thought that this group of at that point elderly people could perhaps serve as a model for how Germany might deal with an aging population, because these elderly people were enormously active. They weren't sitting alone at home. They weren't shut away in nursing homes or in assisted care living facilities. They were incredibly engaged with one another. They were engaged with the world around them. And they seemed to provide a kind of ideal model of how one might, how one should live one's life as the end of one's life approached. And I think the idea was to think of maybe using generational systems as a way of, or generational networks as a way of supporting old people. So that was kind of why the federal government funded this project. And there were a whole bunch of people involved with it, and I'll just sort of, because I'm going on a bit long about this, but my role in this was to analyze 62 interviews that had been conducted by researchers on this project with 62 members of the Free German Circle. Their average age at the time of the interview was 81 years old. And they spoke for hours, and the interview transcripts were enormously long, or are enormously long, and my job was to provide a kind of psychoanalytic, historical analysis of those interviews, which I did, and then I was going to write a book along with a colleague named Jürgen Roilicke together, in which we were going to write a kind of generational biography, if you will, of these 62 people or of this, and of other members of this organization. He turned out not to be able to do this, I think because he in many ways idealized these people. These were, I think for him in many ways, the parents or the father in particular that he had not had, because his father died in the Second World War. And for me, I had a very different reaction to them, a much more critical reaction, because they were also the age of my parents.
Right.
But whereas my parents were, My mom was not German, obviously, but my dad was Austrian, had been in the youth movement, believe it or not, sort of the Austrian version of the Boy Scouts. But because of he was racially Jewish, according to the Nazi criteria, he had to flee Austria, and he could never have been a member of this Free German Circle or a member of the, during the 30s in Germany, he would never have been a member of the youth movement because it was really quite anti-Semitic in many ways. And all of these, or virtually all of the people that were interviewed, whose interviews I read, virtually all of them were very enthusiastic Nazis. And it would have been, so I had a much more critical, attitude toward them. And I think, that was one of the things, you know, I said I didn't choose this project, that made this tough for me psychologically to deal with, because particularly when I was writing what is in many ways the heart of the book, which is about these people during the Third Reich, I was constantly aware of my own potential victimhood vis-a-vis these people. I was, you know, when you're a historian, you are very much using your imagination. That's one of the reasons history is so great. And I was trying to imagine my way and think my way inside the world of the Third Reich. And that's a very unpleasant place to live in one's imagination. And on the other hand, too, the Third Reich kind of began to inhabit me as well. And I found it quite difficult to write that, to spend, you know, during the months that I worked on the Third Reich, and it was very many months, maybe even a year, I found it a very difficult and oftentimes painful experience. So again, maybe not something I would have chosen willingly, but I'm really glad I did. I think I've managed to work through some issues connected with the role of the Holocaust in my own family, in part because I worked on this period so intensively. But I am aware that Anna mentioned earlier that I did these composite interviews, and I'm very well aware of the fact that I felt oftentimes sort of helpless, or had sort of experiences of helplessness when I was, or potential victimhood when I was thinking about the lives of these people during the Third Reich. And it's conceivable that these composite interviews that I created, in which I very much created, I mean, I kind of mastered the past and shaped it to be what I wanted it to be, and perhaps also my argument about these people reflects an effort on my part to kind of contradict or go against the feelings of helplessness that I experienced by sort of exerting domination over these people. But anyway, so that's how I got to it. That's what it's like what I've done in the past. And that's also how it's different, because it was a world that I ended up inhabiting intellectually and also emotionally that was not always easy to inhabit.
It's really interesting. So you see the effort, the making of the composites as an effort on your part to master, to gain control over these people. I was going to ask you about the composites, and do you think, well, what went into making them? Because they were very smooth, and in the introduction you said that, that there was so much repetition, right, in the interviews that you thought it would be more interesting to combine them. Can you just talk about the experience of creating the composite?
Well, I mean, I remember when I thought of doing it for the first time and thinking there were, I remember exactly what it was about. There were two women. I say all this in the book. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've taken is rather, the book has a very unusual structure for a history book, not, you know, the composite interviews most of all, but I also have these essays that are in there.
Right.
I can talk about those later, why they're there. I remember coming to the idea of doing the composite when I was thinking about two women who had written virtually indistinguishable descriptions of living in an apartment from an expropriated Jew. And I thought, you know, these people are saying exactly the same thing. And then I began to look, and I realized that that this was not unusual, that in fact they were often describing the same experiences and the same events in virtually the same language. And I thought, maybe I could somehow put these together. When when you're doing oral history, obviously, I mean, it's like any kind of an interview, which would even be true of a therapy situation. The structure of the interview, the focus of the interview helps shape, obviously, what people say. And all of these people that were interviewed all had the exact same interview situation. They were all expecting to talk about their experiences in the youth movement. They were all expecting to talk about their experiences in this free German circle. So there was a kind of similarity there.
I see.
The other thing is these people, many of them have known each other since they were adolescents. And as a result, they've been talking to one another about their past. I obviously, even though their organization is forward-looking in many ways, obviously the past is what connects them. And I think they've probably been telling these stories and retelling these stories to one another in such a way that a kind of common story has begun to evolve or began to evolve over the years. And then I think, but, you know, this is probably the most fundamental to me, is not so much how the present helps produce the stories of the past and makes the stories similar, but I think what is really decisive is that they actually had very similar pasts and lived very similar lives, and that those pasts and those lives helped create memories that are also very similar. I'm not somebody who believes that memory is simply a product of the present and that what we remember is a kind of creation of the present. I believe, actually, that human beings are historical and that we are very much the product of the past, and that it is the past that shapes us more than the past shapes our present more than the present shapes the past. I think we actually like the idea of being able to think that the present shapes the past because it seems to give us actually more agency and autonomy, whereas if you think that the past is really very much shaping who we are, what we do, and how we think, we become a little less autonomous, and I think that might be difficult for people to take. So anyway, I think the reasons why these stories were very similar, I have to say, and this is something, Anna, you will totally be able to relate to, I found it unbelievably liberating to be able to do these composite interviews with. They were a blast. I had the power. I wasn't constantly scrambling to keep up with history. And, you know, I could decide to, you know, kill off one of these people's mothers or fathers. Mostly it was fathers.
See, that gives me a lot of pleasure. It really does.
Especially for these people. It gave me a lot of pleasure. And I, you know, I have to say, I think this is, you know, I do think my, and again, my own slightly negative or more than slightly negative attitude toward them made it a little easier for me to do that. If I had been in sort of all of these people, I might have found that more difficult. But what I tried to do in this book, and I, you know, I've had a lot of reviews now, and I think this was an extremely good thing for me to have done. What I tried to do in this book is be as open and as honest as I can be, or as I could be, about what I'd done. And so there's no, you know, these interviews don't pretend to be anything but what they are. I, you know, in my introduction, I explain in great detail exactly which choices I made and why I made them and where the fiction, you know, what's fictional and how it's fictional. And I did that also in putting the interviews together when every time I changed a place or a name or a date or tried to make things, you know, more consistent, or I added a phrase to make a transition work. I indicated that. So it is fiction, but it's very opaque, or not opaque. It's very obvious how it's fiction, and I think that's why.
The opposite of opaque,
Yeah, the opposite of opaque. That's why I've been surprised. I have only had one review that was really quite critical of the, not even that critical of the composite interviews. Most of the reviewers have sort of ignored it, which, in a way, I was kind of hoping that this would be a thing, you know, to do, but so far it hasn't been at all. So, yeah. So that's the, as I say, it was really fun,
you know,
to write them, and it was very, very easy.
It's
as
interesting.
As opposed to the rest of the book, which was very, very hard.
Oh, well, let me just say a little bit about the structure. The book goes chronologically. It's divided into three periods. Weimar, the Third Reich, this is rough, right? And the post-war period, is that correct? And then each period has three sections: interviews, where you just you produce the composite, and there are two interviews per section, I believe, one man, one woman. And there's an analysis of the interviews that follows, where you analyze them, do close readings, and then this essays section, which follow, which is in every period you have, which provides a kind of historical, I guess, a historical context and also a historiographical context. You intervene in a number of debates by historians in those essays.
Yep. Exactly the perfect characterization.
Right. And also there's the essays part also presents other kinds of sources that complement the interviews and kind of can be read with or against the interviews, right?
Right.
So that's the structure. Now, empathy, of course, runs through the whole book. Well, two concepts, really. There are a number of concepts. I won't mention all of them. The big ones are generation and empathy, even more so. And actually, as you were talking about your reactions to these interviewees, I thought, you know, do you think, I thought about empathy, and is it important for you, you seem to suggest, or you imply, or maybe you even say it directly, I'm not sure, that it's important for the historian to feel empathy, to experience empathy while writing or toward his or her subjects or objects of study. And when I was reading the composites, I actually have to admit that I don't think I felt empathy in the way that you define empathy, because I can say I felt sympathy, like when they would describe privation or, you know, just very harsh conditions, particularly at the end of the war and or right after the war. I felt sad for them, or I felt bad for them, and or when one of their children died or something. But I can't say that I could put myself in their shoes, and nor did I really want to. And I'm wondering if that was such a bad thing. So maybe you can talk about what you mean by empathy and whether you were able to experience that for the interviewees, even as you were not very sympathetic, I guess, or even hated them at points, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At one point, Anna, we could go back maybe to the essays, because I wouldn't mind talking about why they're there. But let me just, at this point, answer your question about empathy. I think that where the empathy is most apparent in the book is in the analytical section.
Mm-hmm.
I see empathy as being, you know, yes, in German the word is Einfühlung, which means feeling your way inside someone else's experience. And I think feeling may play some role in historical understanding. But I think it's actually more thinking one's way inside, and it's kind of somewhat more of an intellectual process. So where I think empathy plays the biggest role is in my efforts to make sense of these people, to understand why they felt what they felt and thought what they thought and did what they did. So I think that is where, you know, that comes in most during the analytical section, where I try to make an argument, really, that this generation of Germans, generally, but this generation of members of the Free German Circle in particular, experienced a number of serious losses over the course of their lives, beginning in adolescence, and that the losses that these people experienced, they weren't able to work through or mourn or in some ways really process appropriately psychologically, and what they ended up doing was, instead of coming to terms with these losses, mourning them, they found sustenance for what they had lost in the group. And that throughout
the
these people's lives, these people have overcome loss by merging with, becoming part of a group. And this began already in adolescence, when at the end of the First World War, the families of these interviewees and the country as a whole suffered a whole series of losses based on primarily on having lost the war, on the consequences of the war itself, the hyperinflation of 1923, and that all of these, historically, these historical events, if you will, produced losses for Germans, including particularly the parents of this generation of interviewees, and that because the losses were in the family produced by history, the family could not provide the support for these young people that the family normally would have provided. And this right. included not just the family itself, the nuclear family, but also the kind of institutions that were associated with the older generations, like the schools or the churches, because the teachers were also adversely affected by history and were not as, you know, were suffering from really low self-esteem, from depression, oftentimes from ill health as a result of the war. The parents of these of this generation of Germans that I studied really suffered greatly as a result of the events at the end of the war, and were weakened. And in the case of the people that I, whose interviews I read, an astonishing 40% of those people lost a parent, most often the father, at the end of the during the 1920s. And so, in the faces of these losses, this generation of Germans turned to the group to find the support that they had hoped to find in the family, or that one might have expected to find in the family, and or in the particularly in the father in some instances. And so they found this in the group, and then this pattern continued. And in the Third Reich, the youth movement group was replaced by the what was called the Volksgemeinschaft, the community of the people. Which, to my mind, is the sort of central ideological tenet of National Socialism, connected very much with anti-Semitism and racism, and that they flourished in the Third Reich because it was such a collectivist society. Not only was the whole nation understood as a racial collective, but there were loads and loads of groups for people the age of these interviewees to join, where they had the intense kinds of group experiences that they'd had in the youth movement. This got even more pronounced during the war. For the men, it was the army. But for the women, because the men were at the front, virtually all the women interviewees, and there were many of them, there were more women than men, mainly because they lived longer than the men, found intense fulfillment in group activities during the Third Reich in the war, in something called the Reich Work Service, or in the military auxiliary, and other Nazi organizations during the war that made them feel intensely alive, intensely supported. And that's why, when asked about what was the happiest time of their life, women in particular immediately say it was the Third Reich. So then the war ended, the Nazi Germany collapsed, losses on really an unimaginable scale occurred, affecting every one of these interviewees, every member of their generation, and virtually every German. And in the case of these interviewees, at least, they found sustenance after the war by once again finding a group, namely, in this case, this Free German Circle. And that became kind of a successor to the groups of the Third Reich that had sustained them, and the successor to the youth movement that had sustained them, all, I would say, in the face of loss. So where is empathy in that? It's trying to understand why the group was so important for these people. And I think, thinking my way inside their experience, the interpretation emerged that the group became a way to compensate for loss that these people had experienced. Loss was produced not kind of individually, but collectively by the forces of history.
Do you think that the group inhibited their ability to feel empathy for Jews? Because one of the central theses of the book is, which I think we haven't gotten to yet, but anyway, is that that the Holocaust basically happened, or these Germans, that these interviewees and their generation looked away from the genocide because they couldn't empathize with Jewish people.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering about the relationship between this inability to do that and their attachment to the group. I mean, there's almost, I don't want to say this because I want to believe also in a kind of collective or collectivism as a kind of way of life, but it almost, the way that it's presented in the book, it feels almost pathological, like their attachment to the group kind of, it dismantled their capacity for empathy.
Right. Well, and I think it's not just that it dismantled it, but that given the nature of that group and the importance of belonging to that group, it was necessary to have people who couldn't belong to that group. I, you know, maybe it's true of every group. I'm not sure about this, but I'm guessing that every single intensely experienced group requires people who cannot belong to it. Whether that's like in your world, you know, the members of the proletariat requires, you know, the dangerous bourgeoisie.
Or the lumpen proletariat.
Or the lumpen proletariat. In other words, in order for the group to be exclusive, and particularly in the youth movement was a highly elitist group, the Third Reich, although populist, was very clearly a racially elitist group. So it was extremely important to have people who needed to be excluded from the group. And I think the way one excludes people, and particularly if they're going to be excluded physically and ultimately destroyed, is to cease to experience them as fellow human beings in whose place one could imagine oneself being. They have to be other. And I think that it was very important for them to belong to this collective of the Volksgemeinschaft that they not see Jews as human beings like themselves, and that the act of looking away, which is what all of them do, and this is not unique to my group of free Germans, this is a very common response from all oral histories on this period, and also contemporary accounts and diaries and letters and so forth, is that by looking away, you close off the possibility of empathy. You literally don't see them. So on the one hand, you close off the possibility of empathy, but you also kind of eradicate that person from consciousness and from being in a way. And there is, I think, some connection, albeit very different, but still there's some link to the genocide in this looking away and in this closing off of empathy and in this eradication of other people, in order for one to belong to this exclusive group. So
yeah.
I think that in a way, the need to belong, the need to feel a part of something powerful and important that enhances the self, that sustains the self, that empowers the self, that gives people a sense of belonging and security to profound experiences that they had lost at the end of the First World War, those needs were met in the group, but that what enabled the Holocaust to occur, particularly on the part of what we now call bystanders, but I would suspect it's true because I haven't studied the perpetrators exactly, my guess is that all of them, in order to maintain the group cohesion and exclude those who were threats to the group, close off empathy from the people that they wanted to eradicate, and that's how they were able to kill them.
One of the things that struck me was that it seemed like they didn't even do something, sort of short of empathy, like being able to put themselves into the position of the Jews or think their way into it. They also weren't even able to kind of tolerate otherness or maybe have respect for the otherness of the other. They just were very, they couldn't really assimilate that these people were different from them. And that was going to be okay. Like human, but different.
Right. That was not, the human, but different doesn't seem to have been really much of an option for them. And of course, this is one instance where we live in a very different world now than they lived in back then. We live in a multicultural society, and we live in a culture that, or in a country that, at least in its official image of itself, celebrates difference and celebrates diversity, and is proud of the melting pot, and And these people grew up in a world where everyone looked like them and talked like them and came more or less from the same social class. And they weren't accustomed to dealing with difference, and I think they found difference very frightening. So, you know, but that said, on the other hand, this is a generation that was a kind of a transitional generation, and what they particularly liked, whose interviews I read were middle-class educated Germans, basically, or upper-middle-class educated Germans, but what many of them liked was being in these Nazi organizations like the Arbeitsdienst or the Reichswehr Service or the Wehrmacht, particularly the women, actually, not so much the men in the Wehrmacht, but the women actually enjoyed getting to know and working together with women who were of lower social classes, because previously they had virtually nothing to do with that. So, yes, this generation was extremely homogeneous and was very comfortable in its homogeneity, but at least you get the beginning of the kind of social opening that now, you know, characterizes Western Europe. Yes, there are class distinctions and they're still powerful, but it's nothing like it was, in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And the whole, you know, I have to say the Nazis are part of the whole process, or need to be understood as part of the process of social opening, because they were very much, at least on an ideological level, of breaking down class boundaries and making sure that everyone worked together, at least for a time in their lives, with members of the other social classes from other parts of Germany, from where they grew up. And this was accomplished in the Hitler Youth, and it was accomplished in the Reichswehr Service, and it was also part of the experience in the German army. Although, I have to say there, I think the men that I dealt with were more threatened by the social opening. These sort of he-manly proletarians kind of seemed sort of scary to some of them, I think. And also, in the army, the people that I interviewed, whose interviews I read, often were officers, and therefore kind of step removed from the working class people. But that was not true of the women. The women were actually working together with, living together with women of all different social classes in their work camps or in their military auxiliary units or whatever.
Yeah. Well, apropos of, I want to get back to something you said earlier about looking away and just talking about the experience. Because the interviewees often said things like, I knew, but I didn't know. And it seemed like those phrases were repeated, and that's why you included them in the, they knew, but they didn't know about the final solution. Sorry, I should be more specific. So I think that's why you included those phrases in the composites. And I actually wanted to read a quote. It's kind of a long one, but it sent chills down my spine. And I thought I'll read it and maybe you can comment on it and tell us what's going on here. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. They slunk along the street. They looked so frightened, I'd have to say. I thought to myself, that simply can't be. And then once I saw in the Buckstrasse that people were being transported away. I once saw the Jews with stars, ellipsis, and actually numerous families, Jewish families, lived there. But then I saw, ellipsis, I can still remember exactly, I came from the side and saw the Jews were literally being herded together. I saw it, and I looked away, and I thought about something else. I continued on my way and didn't get upset about it. How can something like that happen? Or that one registers what is actually happening. But I know I saw it. I can still see it exactly before my eyes. They wore the star and were literally being herded together in the street. And in retrospect, I consider that to be our guilt, that we didn't concern ourselves about it. I thought about prettier things than about that. Already after taking 3 steps, I was thinking about something else. I basically didn't acknowledge it to myself, although I still know it and can still see the picture exactly before me. Back then, I won't say I repressed it. I simply didn't consciously acknowledge it, not consciously. Okay, so tell us what you think is going on there, and how often you saw this in interviews, some kind of similar statement.
Is that from the composite interviews?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I think that's actually two different people.
Okay.
And I think I actually go into this again, although maybe I don't quote it as fully in the analytical section. The one person who's talking here, it's better to kind of disaggregate them maybe a little bit.
Sure.
The one person who's talking is fairly cold-hearted about it, even now, when she's being interviewed, whereas the other one is very self-aware and feels bad. And the one who feels bad is the one who says, you know, I looked at it, I saw it, it's not that I didn't register, I don't remember exactly what the quotation is, but I thought about prettier things than that. After a few steps, I was thinking about something completely different, and that's what I consider to be our guilt. And that's mm-hmm. She's the more self-aware, in a way, person. It seems to me that those are the only two where something that dramatic is presented. I think recent research, it's not just my book, but just recent research has made it very, very clear that virtually every German actually did know about the Holocaust, on some level at least.
Right.
That in some ways all Germans on one level or another engaged in this very same process of looking away and thinking about prettier things than that. I think, yes, some of the explanation could be that they were afraid, that if they saw this, they'd actually have to take a position on it. And if they took a position on it, that it was good that this was happening. This might make them feel uneasy because somewhere they may have felt that these are human beings too, and this is not something that should happen to them. Or they would think this is bad, and if they think it's bad, they have a choice, but they do something about it. But they were probably afraid to do something about it, so they did nothing about it, and then they'd feel guilty. So that's kind of for not doing something. So that's probably the way most people would interpret this, and I think there's a great deal to be said for that interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's also more than that. I think there is a way that this connects with what in many ways anti-Semitism or racism in general may be, which is a lack of empathy. I think it really is, on some basic level, not wanting to register other people as human beings. And I think part of it is, this is closer to the first interpretive constellation that I described, that I think these people wanted to experience good feelings on a most basic level. And they weren't so great at tolerating bad feelings, in part because I think they were quite damaged psychologically as a result of these losses that I discussed earlier.
Right.
So they can't tolerate bad feelings. And looking at these people being transported away or huddling shyly in the street or slinking along or whatever wouldn't have made them feel good. So they didn't want to feel bad, so they looked away. So I think there's something, some of that there. But I think that this looking away goes to the heart of the Nazi project. The Nazi project is about excluding this group of, this category of being. They didn't want to acknowledge them as people, but let's say they are people. They did not want to acknowledge Jews as part of the human race. They wanted to eradicate them and everything that Jews represented from the human race and from the world. And that looking away is a form of that eradication. And I think there's a way that if you're a German, a non-Jewish German, and this is described numerous things like this, this is during the war when Jews are still allowed to go out during certain restricted hours, and they're all made to wear this star on their coats or whatever. And, it's a very, common description that a non-Jewish German is walking down the street and coming towards him. Let's use him because that's the one I can remember. He sees a man wearing a Jewish star coming toward him. There oftentimes the word shyly is used to describe the Jews as if they were like shy, but actually they're humiliated, terrified, not wanting to be seen for fear of what will happen to them. And this is then interpreted as shyness. Anyway, that's a very common trope that Jews, I guess that's the right word to describe the Jews wearing the star. But so this person, the non-Jewish German, sees the Jew coming towards him wearing the star, and he crosses the street so as not to have to pass him. There's no, it's not like a conscious thought, I don't want to see, they just, it would make me feel uneasy. And that's something that's repeated in oral history after oral history and in, you know, contemporary accounts during the Third Reich as well. People didn't want to feel uneasy, and I think that there's something about, you know, the reason that the Jews had to be excluded from Germany was that the Jews made Germans feel uneasy. This was an alien presence within the community of the folk, and this getting rid of them would make us feel comfortable again. This is not in my book, but it's in a book by Peter Fritsche, who describes a school class, like elementary school class. And there was it was in Berlin, and there was a large number of Jewish students in this class. And on one of the Jewish high holidays, all the Jews were gone from the class. And the teacher said to the other students, or the pupils, "Isn't it wonderful, today we're just here among us." And I think that there's something about that experience of just being among us that is connected with this looking away phenomenon.
Well, actually, related to this, you say in the book that, two points. You say two interesting things. One is that you characterize, I think you're talking about the quote that I read, but maybe it was a different one, that it was, you characterize the reaction as a vertical split, you know, or maybe a disavow, like a structure of "I know very well, but," or even a denial, which is a more primitive, I guess, defense. Are you going back? I mean, because it seems like you're saying something a little bit different now. And then the other, have you changed your mind about it? And I wonder what you think about that now. And you also said that there, in some cases you felt like there was repression, there was a horizontal split involved, but you didn't really give, I don't know, I'm not sure that I know what that might look like based on the interviews that you presented.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that this gets back to the whole issue that is of enormous interest to some scholars about, you know, did the Germans know about the Holocaust? Mm. And to me, this is a kind of very, from a psychoanalytic point of view, naive question.
Right.
Because it kind of assumes very clearly either one knows or one doesn't know. And I think we all know that people can know things on all kinds of different levels.
Right.
And I think the probably, you know, what I would say, the woman that looks at the Jews being deported and then looks away and thinks about something else, that's a kind of what I would call simply repression, a repression of the perception. Now maybe you could argue that it's not even that far yet, because it's not even the perception, she says, has not even registered in her consciousness, which she never actually ever saw, perhaps. But I can imagine, I guess what I was trying to characterize by this horizontal split is that you see it and then you look away from it and you suppress what you've seen.
Right.
But what's so striking in the interviews, is the number of times when interviewees say first, it seems to always be in this direction, you know, "We knew nothing about the Holocaust." And then within a sentence sometimes almost in the same sentence, they acknowledge that they did know about the Holocaust.
Right.
So I think that I'm trying to characterize as a vertical split where you both know and don't know at the same time. And I don't really pretend to understand why in interview after interview this occurs. And it's not just in in the interviews that I look at, but there are in other oral history interviews as well. And it's often, it's quite interesting, it often starts with the statement, I didn't know, and then immediately thereafter, I did know. It doesn't start out with, I did know, but then, and then going to, I didn't know. It's the other, always the other way around. I don't pretend to understand that. I think it would be really interesting to, you know, look at all the instances and all the kinds of interviews that exist where this phenomenon manifests itself to try to figure out what exactly the process is. I mean, there have been some explanations for it, but I find them not persuasive at all. And particularly for the direction, you know, that it starts out with, I didn't know, but I didn't.
What do you make of that, the direction of it? You think it's obviously very significant?
Well, it's just noticeable, but I don't know. I mean, so there's three explanations that I've heard that I can remember right now. And one is the least interesting, and that is that when they're asked the question, "Did you know about the Holocaust?" They're thinking about Auschwitz, and they think they didn't know about Auschwitz, so they say no.
But then they didn't know about extermination camps. They knew about camps,
They knew about the killing of the Einsatzgruppen, they knew about other things. So that's the least psychologically interesting. Another explanation is that by saying they don't know, they're trying to absolve themselves of guilt and sort of take a moral position. But then when they talk about what they do know, there's a kind of a recognition that they do have some guilt. I don't remember. There's a third one that comes from the work of Gabriel Rosenthal, and I can't remember exactly what it is. I think it's partly that if they acknowledge their guilt completely, they'd be overwhelmed by it and would be unable to function. So that they kind of dose their guilt by acknowledging only partial knowledge. But that the global "I didn't know" is a kind of way not to be overwhelmed by guilt. In my sense there, if that were the case, the interviews would have gone in the other direction. You would have started out by saying, "I did know," and then the guilt starts to get bigger and bigger, and you're going to get overwhelmed, so then you say, "No, but I really didn't know." But instead, it's always the other way around, so that makes me somewhat skeptical about that explanation. But, you know, look, I don't pretend to understand this. I just don't know.
You say something very, very good about, I think, very interesting about perception and knowledge, the difference between the two, that I believe you say that knowledge is more social. So they perceived, but they couldn't really assimilate because it wouldn't be socially sanctioned. So that contributes.
And particularly because, you know, social sanction is so important if you're belonging to this intensely experienced group. So, you know, what you know along with everyone else in the group helps make you a group, and you are not allowed to know what the group doesn't sanction because that excludes you from the group or separates you from the group. So there's a way that group cohesion and knowledge are intimately intertwined for these people.
Right. Wow. Okay, so I wanted to, before we conclude, I really wanted to get to the post-war years just to say a few things that really struck me, at least. That women, you've already touched on this, that women, when they talk about the war, and they talk about it very differently from the men, because it's amazing to me that the women were see themselves as having been empowered by the war, even though at the very end, like many of them were near starvation and they were raped repeatedly by occupying Soviet soldiers. They talk about the end of the war. And I think the Third Reich as a whole, right, as something that was very empowering for them. And the men are kind of, they're pretty much reluctant to talk about the war and the immediate post-war period. The other interesting part is that they all characterize themselves as being optimistic people. I mean, they're deeply conservative. They're kind of isolated, but they're also very optimistic. And you engage this a bit, and again, you've touched on this already, but in relation also to the Mitscherlich famous essay "Inability to Mourn," published in I think 1967, which Alexander and Margaret Mitscherlich claimed that Germans couldn't work through their many losses, right? And so
no, they did claim that, but they should have.
Oh, they should have. No, you say that. Sorry. Maybe
right.
You say.
They so claim let me that the actually, Germans were.
Yeah. Go ahead.
They claimed that the Germans were unable to mourn.
That's right. That's right.
Because to do so would have confronted them with guilt that they couldn't face.
Right, and you claim the you invert this, and you say that.
That's exactly right.
Right. The inability of the Germans to mourn their losses
prevented them.
Right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Feeling guilt.
Right, which I think is totally right.
Loss is more important for this group than guilt. Later, in the 60s, when the Mitscherlichs were writing, guilt in Germany became experienceable, if you can use that word.
Mm.
And but in the 50s, when people were recovering from the kind of devastating losses that they'd experienced, they had no capacity. They had not had much capacity to empathize with other people anyway, and they had even less capacity when they were trying to deny the losses that they had experienced. And I really, one cannot underestimate the kind of catastrophic losses that Germans experienced at the end of World War II.
You know, I thought about the Torok and Abraham essays on incorporation and mourning. You know, when the sudden loss of an object, when there's a sudden loss and there's shame surrounding that object, and introjection is prevented, but you get instead incorporation, a kind of swallowing whole of an encryption of the object. So people who have done this kind of walk around without feeling guilt, without any melancholia, because as far as they're concerned, they haven't lost anything. They've just incorporated it and hidden it deep within somewhere. And that they remain optimistic as long as those walls that, you know, of the crypt are not shaken, presumably by like analysis or something. Because I felt like I was expecting them to talk more about actually the like nightmares or panic attacks or some kind of negative, you know, traumatic symptoms of trauma, and they seem to not talk about that at all.
Right.
Even though they clearly had psychoanalytic language available to them, like that woman who said it wasn't repression. I wouldn't say I repressed it. Like, this is interesting, right? That she's using this.
Right. Well, one of the things that's very, partly because of this article by the Mitscherlichs that you mentioned, Germany in general is a much more psychoanalytically sympathetic society than the United States is. And the whole notion that people need to work through loss and come to terms with the past, the famous Vergangenheitsbewältigung, is on some level a deeply psychoanalytic concept in the way that it's understood by Germans. And it is a complete part of discourse in Germany, and not just among the educated upper middle classes. So it's just sort of the way the world is. And I think so that this kind of language is available to Germans, and they use it, particularly in dealing with Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. My interpretation of the optimism, I think yours is a, you know, again, it's just a different theoretical language, but I think the way you present it is really interesting and compelling, and I hadn't, you know, thought of it that way. I saw it basically as a defense, these people were very brittle and very fragile and very, very, very well defended, and that the idea that they can, you know, they couldn't, you know, just like you can't tolerate Jews in the perfect Aryan homogeneous society, you can't interpret bad things or bad feelings. Everything has to be turned into something optimistic and wonderful. And they try really hard to make loss into something positive. And they try, we didn't talk about this, but these interviewees had terrible, terrible troubles with their own children, the famous 1968 generation, who seemed to be quite disturbed from their descriptions of their children. They seem, in many instances, to be almost completely alienated from their children. That seems to be the one loss in these people's lives that they can't sort of make into something positive. So I understood these people as being quite damaged by these losses, that the group was a kind of, I don't know what the right word, a compensatory structure, but didn't actually get as internalized as maybe you know, they relied on the group to provide psychological functions that they didn't have within themselves and that you would want normally people to be able to have within themselves, like a sense of self-esteem, a sense of security, a sense of self-confidence. All of that was kind of shared with others because they didn't have the wherewithal within themselves to kind of regulate their own affects. So I understood them as quite fragile and brittle. And, you know, what is interesting is they were asked, generally in these interviews, they were just told talk, you know, just speak about your life story, and off they go, and they talk about their lives, and there wouldn't be a lot of, interruption or almost no interruption on the part of the interviewers, but they were asked specifically at the end of the interview, do you have any dreams that you remember? And almost none of them could remember dreams or were willing to talk about them, but they claimed they couldn't. But in every single dream, I say this in the book, in every single dream that is recounted, the dreams are about loneliness or loss. People alone or people dealing with loss. I see them, you know, they're near the end of their lives when they're interviewed. They don't talk about death, which is the ultimate loss. They're, you know, there's this kind of relentless don't worry, be happy mentality that I find found off-putting. And so I interpreted this whole, you know, this is a story of a generation that experienced devastating losses and that compensated for those losses with the group. But I'm willing to concede that, you know, because on some level I'm not particularly sympathetic to them, that maybe I wanted to see them as miserable and unhappy, and maybe they're as happy as they said they were. But I really, really seriously doubt. There's only one guy who conceded that he had been suicidal.
Wow.
I think he had actually attempted suicide. And there is no question that he is the warmest, most human, most attractive man in the interview sample. So hey, just one last thing I wanted to say,
yes.
Anna, to get back to the thing about women.
Mm-hmm.
So the interviews were, you know, just tell us your life story and then, you know, go from here. And I think, you know, all these people came and with the expectation that they were going to talk about the youth movement particularly and then maybe the Free German Circle. But the women in many, many instances rushed to be able to speak about their behavior and experiences at the end of the war or during the last, you know, months of the war when things were absolutely terrible and they engaged some of them on these treks from the east back to the west.
Unbelievable, right.
Seeing the Red Army, and they felt themselves intensely alive. The immediate post-war period, they felt themselves to be survivors, to be incredibly effective in dealing with this collapsed society, raising little children, when the men came home, propping the men up. I think in many ways, the women found the whole collapse of the patriarchy, if you will, liberating. And the men, by contrast, I think suffered much, much more than the women in the end and didn't have the inner strength to be able to flourish under those terrible circumstances. They'd been defeated in war. They'd been placed in POW camps where they were treated terribly. And when they came back, they felt emasculated. And as a result, their experience was much more devastating. They weren't able to see anything really positive about it, so they were generally very quiet about how they felt at the end of the war. They generally do not talk about the war. They certainly, almost none of them talk about captivity, except for the one guy I mentioned, who the human guy, who said that he still has terrible nightmares about being in an American POW camp, which is nothing to speak of the Soviet camps that most of them were in. Then the men sort of rushed off after the war to work, and create the so-called economic miracle and, you know, threw themselves into work. Again, the standard reigning interpretation by psychologically minded historians was this drive to achieve prosperity was a defense against guilt feelings for what had been done during the Third Reich.
Mm.
I don't believe these people really felt guilty. And instead, I think this rush into work and into achieving prosperity was a defense against, or not a defense, but an attempt to avoid the losses that they had felt, and based upon an inability to mourn the losses that they'd experienced.
Right. I often feel like, yeah, there's an assumption that there's guilt there somewhere, and I'm not so convinced. I'm with you.
I'm not either.
No. Yeah. Well, anyway, we should really wrap up. Thank you, Tom, again. I just want to repeat the title. We've been talking to Thomas Kohut about A German Generation, an Experiential History of the 20th Century. Thanks for doing this, Tom, and thanks to our audience for listening. Till next time.